Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences at Loughborough University. Today I'm with Professor Sophia Jowett and Director of Football, Rebecca Savuk, and we're going to talk about the coach-athlete relationship, including how to develop a good coach-athlete relationship and the impact that this can have on performance.
So, hi Sophia, hi Rebecca.
Hi Marty.
Hey Martin, thanks for having us on.
No problem. It's great having you on. As I've mentioned to you guys already, I will disappear into the ether and you guys can chat because you guys are the experts. It's great, going to be great to listen to you. But before we get into the details around coach-athlete relationship, can you give our listeners a bit of a background to your work and your experience? So starting with yourself, Sophia.
Okay. Thanks very much, Martin. A great question, and I'll try to keep it very, very brief. So my work revolves around coaching. I'm very interested to understand the coaching, the complex dynamics that involve. And I take a particular approach to try to understand coaching, and that is through relationships, the relationships that coaches and athletes develop over time, and through the ways they communicate, as well as I'm particularly interested in how coaches lead and what are their behaviors and how these impact their athletes. I started this work back in 1997. Believe it or not, time flies, doesn't it? As a PhD student at the University of Exeter, and where I kind of realized that the interpersonal dynamics involved between coaches and athletes were primarily investigated through coach leadership, what coaches do to athletes to be who they are and perform. So I thought that was a little bit too unidimensional, and therefore I started looking at the relationship and the reciprocal impact that the coach and the athlete have, and in fact defined coaching through the relationships coaches and athletes develop. Over the years, I taught at the University of Staffordshire, and since 2003, at Loughborough University. So this year is 20 years. I celebrate 20 years at Loughborough University. And the research has flourished since. So I'm very pleased to be here and to work at a great institution. So that is me in a nutshell. I don't know how much you would like me to go into.
That's good. Yeah. Congratulations on the 20 years. Bex, we'll pass over to you.
I mean, I'm not sure how I follow that, to be honest, Martin. I'll give it a bit of a go. So, look, firstly, I'm super excited to be on this call with Sophia. I've been a big fan of your research for a number of years. I've used it in the classroom with my students when I was a lecturer at Hertfordshire. So really excited to kind of listen to your research firsthand and find out a little more about the coach-athlete relationship. In terms of myself, I've been in football, you know, came through a talent centre in Cambridgeshire a number of years ago, started on my coaching badge journey at the age of 17, managed to get my A licence by 24, 25, so that would have been 2012, and I've been in football ever since. I did my undergrad at Man Met with Dr. Ryan Groom and Dr. William Taylor, did my master's there as well, and started on my PhD journey in around about 2018-19, and I'm still working hard behind the scenes to try to complete that, but it's hard to juggle everything. In terms of football roles, I've managed and been an assistant manager in the Women's Championship. I've worked in the national pathway and done some talent camps for the FA. I did four seasons with Watford in the boys academy and worked in the youth development phase with players from under 12 to 16, which was fantastic and a real challenge. And I currently am director of football at Loughborough, which, you know, has been a real fantastic journey for me this last year. I've really enjoyed it. Taken on a bit more of a strategic role rather than off on pitch this year, and oversee men's football, women's football, futsal, officiating and coaching here at the university.
That's awesome. My listeners will now understand why I'm just saying I'm just going to sit in the background and let you two talk. So it's going to be brilliant. So let's just get this started by, I know, Sophia, you mentioned the long time that you've been researching this. So in that time, how has coaching changed over those years?
Well, I suppose we can approach this question in many different ways, Martin, but today here, I will approach it like this. So what we have noticed over the years and what indeed have witnessed through my research and through just being a fan of sport is that the coaching has changed quite dramatically, I would say. So when sport started, you know, as we can go as far as back in the ancient Olympic Games, we would probably see that it was predominated by what coaches did, how the coaches delivered coaching. Coaches played a central role. They were at the heart of coaching. They directed the coaching of an athlete, the practice, the training, and they led, they guided, they supported. Everything revolved around coaches. The role of the athlete was very secondary in that. I was an athlete myself many, many years ago. I represented Greece in athletics, and I had three wonderful coaches. In that time, none of my three coaches ever asked me, so what are your dreams, your aspirations? What are your likes and dislikes? I was never part of the coaching process. So it was very much coach-led, coach-centered. What I have noticed going on, and what, you know, we talk a lot about nowadays, particularly I will say in the last 20 or so years, is that we have moved from a coach-centered approach to a more athlete-centered approach, whereby now what we see is the athlete is at the center of coaching and the athlete is the protagonist. We expect quite a lot from the athlete, if we are to be perfectly honest here. We expect the athletes to know and understand their own needs and wants. And we expect the athletes to develop, design their training in one way or another, to work with them, their teammates, their coaches, and other members of staff. We want them, there is no doubt about that, to be more accountable and responsible for their development and progression. The coaches take a kind of a less of a role, I will say. And that is all good. But at the same time, I think it's a very challenging a way of looking at coaching. And I'm not quite sure how realistic that narrative is and how in the real world this can work and will work quite successfully. So what I have proposed is that perhaps we move away slightly from both approaches, both the coach and the athlete-centered approach. And perhaps we think of coaching from a more coach-athlete-centered approach, whereby both the coach and the athlete play an active role. And both the coach and the athlete make joint contributions. And they're both accountable and responsible. And there I say at equal levels, I'm not quite sure how, I may be questioned about, you know, that, but I want both the coach and the athlete to be part of the process and play an active role. They are both responsible and they're both in some ways define the success and effectiveness of coaching. And there will be times where the coach may take a little bit more of a protagonist role and other times, and that would be expected, the athlete will take a protagonist role. What I'm trying to say is that this new approach to coaching, I think, is a little bit more realistic and one that will create much more satisfaction and fulfillment by both members involved in that approach. So this is how I see, in a very simplistic form, I appreciate coaching changing over the years and over the times. And of course, we've got a number of examples, and I'm sure Rebecca will help me here, of coaches who have fallen into these categories or approaches of coaching.
I think as you were talking through that, I was thinking about kind of coaching heroes of my own, and Brian Clough would have been my original hero, not Nottingham Forest Brian Clough. And I remember, I'll misquote him here, but when asked what you do when you disagree with a player or a coach, he said, oh, well, you know, we'd sit down and we'd talk about it and we'd agree that I was right. So, you know, Brian Clough was very direct and very command and control, but were very successful back in, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. And now, again, you know, from a Forest fans perspective, Steve Cooper got us promoted, kept us in the Premier League, and would probably be more of that coach athlete type thing. And if you look at interviews from them, the language that Steve Cooper was using in interviews was then a couple of weeks down the line being used by the players as well, which I think was a really interesting thing when I was watching this. But yeah, I am sure Rebecca has many examples. Have you seen that on the pitch as well, Rebecca, in your coaching experience?
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking through and making a few notes as Sophia was talking there. For me, I would agree. I think firstly, the women's football landscape has changed significantly in the last few years. So you've got, you know, change in landscape, investment, a lot more spotlight, structure, infrastructure, resources. I mean, the topic of professionalisation is up for debate. Some might argue it has professionalised and some might argue we've missed the boat to really do a good, rigorous job of that. In terms of coach centric, when I think about doing my UEFA A licence, 2010 to kind of 2013, it was very dictatorial in that, you know, you got your topic, you've got to do these pictures, get on, stop, stand still, do this way. And then it would be, you know, you'd get signed off and you'd get your points accumulation. Coach education has changed somewhat now, very big on, you know, guiding discovery, Q&A techniques, really player centric. How do we empower athletes to make decisions? How do we promote freedom? How does it session design mirror the game? So like transitions and goals, and how is the game the teacher? You know, and we've gone very much that way in my, this is a personal view. I think at times too much. Would we put a surgeon in a room and go just trial and error that and see how you get on? Probably not. I still think that there's a time and a place for really coaches being able to have that tool in their toolkit, which is direct, which is I'm asking you and telling you to do it this way. Here's why. Here's when. And this is what the value and contribution is to the team and bigger picture thinking. There's modules that have been introduced within the women's game, which are, you know, things like coaching behaviours for the women's game specifically. What are those nuances? Why is it different? What potentially might women benefit from, or do they need a little more than men? I'll give you an example. Working with the boys at Watford, highly competitive, in out with their water breaks, straight back out. If I said, do it this way, boom, they ran off with it. They didn't want to discuss. They didn't need that component within their own peer-to-peer learning. Some might ask me why, but they just wanted to know. They wanted the answer, and then they wanted to go and try it. So a lot more ball rolling time and a lot less questions. And I found, you know, the women's game, that they've got a lot of questions. They really want that sense of belonging. They want to know why. They want to know what the bigger picture is. They want to know why this practice and how does this practice link to the game plan? How is this specifically going to help us beat blah, blah at the weekend? And I think that part of it, the coach has got to have the answers, because there'll be those moments where they'll ask you and it might be in front of a group and you've got to have an answer. Otherwise, in that moment, you might lose the respect of the group instantly. And you know, as we know, that takes a really long time to build and you can lose the respect of your group in a heartbeat, right? So I'd say women's game, a lot more open dialogue, you know, leadership groups, those kind of strategies and open conversation between your athletes to work together to that common goal. So potentially, you know, in my mind, I see that coach-athlete relationship as being more reciprocal in nature, and having those real kind of key anchors that guide conversation and coaching interventions more broadly being really significant.
I wonder if I can pick on something that Rebecca said, which is very interesting and something that I have been, you know, thinking and talking with colleagues. Perhaps you haven't seen much being written on it, Rebecca, but it is interesting that you mentioned about the women's versus men's game and the different practices and processes within it. And when it concerns how coaches operate, and or indeed athletes or players, for that matter. And the distinction you made that, you know, women players will prefer to understand the why, to have a dialogue, to communicate, to have that relationship with the coach, perhaps more readily than what you have observed in the men's game. I wonder whether that is because of the ways that women and men are simply socialized, and what is effective, and we don't know it yet because we haven't actually applied it, particularly in the men's game, is I wonder when where the men's game will improve, will be enhanced, if we were to coach them in the ways that perhaps we coach women, which is exactly, you know, that, like you said, explaining to them why we do what we do instead of sending them to do it because they simply don't ask. But perhaps they don't ask because they have never been asked. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, coaches from the men's and the women's game can come together and talk and exchange, you know, the practices and what are the best practices. Because I think this sharing of information and practices might benefit the game, not the men or the women in the game, but the game of football in this case, in your case particularly. I wonder if you have any thoughts and if you can help me out whilst I'm wrestling with my own thoughts.
Oh, I think you've put some really key questions out there. I think a lot of people will have had similar thoughts and feelings, perhaps. Again, this is a personal view. I think potentially we've football at times has been socialized into a way of thinking, and often that orthodoxy is replicated because we have people who have been a player, then they become a coach, and they reproduce what they've seen and felt from the managers that they've been exposed to. Something that I feel very passionate about is like diversity of thought in coaching teams. So I think it's great to have some coaches in your team that have played or have experienced all of these wonderful role models from the game. But I think there's definitely a time and place for a difference. So that's why I think it's great to have women in coaching teams in key roles. But beyond that, I think there's definitely a place for people with academic backgrounds that have studied, that have analysed, people who have been exposed to multi-sports environments and high performance. And I think that's why Loughborough's been great for me to go and spend some time learning about, for example, Loughborough Lightning rugby team and how Rhys, as director of rugby, has cultivated those performance plans has been hugely insightful, because it will make football better, more analytical, think about marginal gains in a way that perhaps we've been missing currently. So when I think about the men's game or boys academy football, I think it's becoming more open. So the Premier League are doing a huge amount of work educating key leadership roles. So we've got like the academy manager program, we've got heads of coaching programs that I know they'll run courses on, and people are starting to think and be more open at this evolution of practice. I also think people are starting to find their own voice and be a little bit more provocative, curious, challenging with some of their own views. Okay, so why is the philosophy that way? Like, what's the evidence? This is my big thing at the minute. Like, what is our why? And what statistical evidence or what can we read that will help us be more informed in our decision making? Because I think for such a long time, the why was, because we've always done it this way, or I saw it that way and it worked, so we try and reproduce it. But we know when we try to transition those pockets into different club environments or different teams, it's so contextually different, it's really hard to mirror. And I think that you're right, Sophia. I think there's a big misconception that men don't want to be included, or that they don't want to be asked, or they don't want to know why. I think they've been told for such a long time, and that's why it's common practice. But when we've started to layer in some of that at Watford, I think it went really well when they were asked and included, and they bought in, and they knew what the values were and why, or they felt okay to ask questions, and they didn't think the coach was going to view that as a weakness when it come up to retain and release. I think that was healthy. And I think that that's where the game needs to go. As you've rightfully said, men, women, academy, boys, academy, girls, futsal, and, because I think that's healthy.
Really interesting points there, Rebecca. So, yeah, we're going to look at what a good quality coach-athlete relationship looks like. But before we do, there's some really interesting points there. And I think looking at some recent examples. So obviously the women's England football team previously had a male coach in Phil Neville. And now Serena Wiegmann has been doing a fantastic job. So it'd be interesting to know if you've got any insights on like the potential differences that may have happened there. You also mentioned coaching teams. So often there'll be males and females within the coaching team and those relationships. But I think another one that's going to be really interesting to watch is the recent employment of Hannah Dingley at Forest Green Rovers, just to throw out another Loughborough alumni there, getting that kind of first ever role in that space. So, yeah, how do those dynamics kind of change for the playing group as well as the coaching staff when a different gender of leader is put in position?
I guess women and men, you may argue, and I would refer to the great work that my colleagues, Professor Leanne Norman and Professor Nicole Lavoie in UK and USA respectively are doing around this particular area of gender and leadership, but some of the research that we have also done as well. What we have noticed is that women coaches and men coaches perhaps employ different leadership styles or different leadership behaviors or indeed communication patterns. So it may be that women are a little bit more empathic, but again, this might not be because they are females. It may be because they have socialized to be more empathic. They have given more opportunities to express this sort of communication to others, whereas men perhaps a little less. But what we have noticed is that, for example, in our research particularly, that when you have same gender coach and players, then what we noticed is that the relationships are much tighter, much stronger, as opposed to when the gender of the coach and the players or the athlete is different. And it may be, as I said, because of the styles, because of the socialization, because of the expectations that we have. But I guess from, and now again, Rebecca might need your support here. Phil Neville, for me, was one of those very empathic coaches. Was very relatable, was very approachable. This is how perhaps I saw him or understood him reading whatever was available in the media. And of course, what we see from Serena Wiegmann is very much a coach that knows and understands. Both of them were footballers, I suppose, and they have this background under their belt. But also the way that they operate is very much to reach out to the athlete, to the player, to understand them, to understand their needs, to work with them. And therefore, I can see some similarities there. And the transition to me seemed to be quite seamless. But Rebecca, maybe you've got different views in how this coach is operated.
Yeah, I'm happy to try and add a little bit of colour into that. I think, firstly, we definitely need to just touch on, you know, Hannah's appointment at Forest Green, because when I saw that come through at 10:30 at night, that was a moment for like women everywhere to be the first one through that concrete ceiling. And for me, completely deserved, because her profile, skill set, education and is exceptional. And as an academy manager already, it would be a natural, you know, on an interim basis, a club would look at your academy staff anyway to go up and support the first team. So that process isn't an anomaly, and it's certainly not tokenistic. So I find, you know, the social media warriors a little bit, it offends me a bit, because she's definitely earned the right to have that opportunity. And I just absolutely wish her well for every woman everywhere and every male ally in a club will be watching, because I think she can open the door for more women if she does well. So everyone will be wishing her well. But also we've got, you know, last month Lydia Bedford was appointed Brentford men's under 18s head coach. So she's the first woman head coach ever to go in PDP phase head coach role. And again, wonderful. And Liz is a good friend of mine. So we've got a little bit of momentum in those spaces for the first time ever. And it's so significant. I think we can have masculine women and feminine men, right? So it might not just be solely on the that gendered part. I think it really goes into like personality and those social traits and what people can offer and how they interact with human beings on that level. I think Phil was appointed in a really transitional moment for English football, and English women's football was a great profile, brought a lot of media attention and helped it move on again, which was really important. And Serena's appointment for me was just groundbreaking. I mean, to get somebody in like her, who has won at a national level already in tournament football, just breathes confidence. Right, we've got a winner. We've got somebody who can deliver in big moments. What changed for me, because I, you know, we sit and we watch, you know, Gareth Southgate came so close, and I was sat there in the final that day when we missed those penalties. Now, you know, you kind of sat on the edge of your seat thinking, has he got the minerals to get it done? And you're hoping he has, haven't you? You're hoping. Right, Serena, Spain, knockout football. We're losing 1-0, 10 minutes, 15 minutes to go. Has she got the minerals? She puts Millie Bright up front, changes the structure, the system, and we get a goal, and it's 1-1 extra time, and we win that game 2-1 against one of the best teams in the world. And all of a sudden, you find yourself going from asking the questions, can she, to this sense of knowing she can, like she can do it. So she could have checked the next few games for me. She could have done whatever she wanted tactically, and I'm bought in. I'm bought into what she's doing. I know she can do it. She's just knocked out Spain, like one of the favourites for that tournament. So I've gone from like all of these internal questions. Can we win? Can we do it? We've got the best players. We've got to just go in. I'm completely bought in to Serena. And I've heard she's a fantastic man manager. She can be very direct and very clear in her processes. But she almost at this point in her journey and career with the, she can't do any wrong in my eyes. I'm bought into her success already at this summer tournament. And think it will be a really exciting time for us.
That is a great comment you've made about being bought in, because we all kind of can have that discussion about managers, you know, players get managers sacked because they're not bought in. They've just, you know, he's lost the dressing room or all that kind of conversation. So you need that good quality coach athlete relationship. So, you know, I know it's different in different scenarios and all the rest of it. But if we could have a kind of discussion around what are the main ingredients that build that good quality coach athlete relationship?
Very good. And that has been a research we have been conducting for a long, long time in order to kind of crystallize our view about what is what we call today the coach-athlete relationship. So as you will expect, the coach-athlete relationship is a multidimensional construct, a multidimensional idea. It's not simple or easy to capture. But I think, you know, through the research we have conducted thus far, the way we see it at the moment is quite valid. So here is how we can understand what it is, a rather elusive and complex phenomenon in tangible ways. So the coach-athlete relationship contains four dimensions. The first dimension is called closeness. The second, commitment. The third, complementarity. And the fourth, co-orientation. And I will take each one in turn to describe it. So briefly. So closeness reflects coaches and athletes' interpersonal feelings and describes the emotional tone of the relationship. It essentially captures important relational properties such as coaches and athletes' trust to one another, respect, appreciation, and liking. These are the four key relational properties: trust, respect, appreciation, and interpersonal liking. And I guess we will all agree that, and very often, coaches at whatever level they may be operate, from participation to high-level performance to Olympic and Paralympic and professional, they will always say how important it is to trust their athletes and how important athletes is to trust the coaches. So we believe that closeness is a very important dimension in that framework. The next one is commitment. Commitment simply captures coaches and athletes' intentions, motivations, willingness to maintain a close relationship over time. And again, we know that commitment is hugely important because we will all agree, I'm sure, that high performance or development of skills doesn't happen overnight. We need to stick with the coach. The coach needs to stick with the athlete for a period of time to try the, each other and what they're trying to achieve together. In addition, commitment is important because it's the glue that connects the coach and the athlete during difficult times. And we know that in the career of the athlete and the coach, there will be highs and lows. There will be twists and turns in that path that they are leading. And commitment is the one that will keep them together. Now, here I refer to specific examples like injury, which are commonplace, burnout, again, commonplace for both the coach and the athlete, and personal circumstances, you know, where we've got student athletes here on the campus where they have exams. They have difficult times with their other side of their life, which is not just sport, which is their education, their, you know, which is highly important for them, and I believe to their coaches as well, as much as to the teachers ourselves. So that is commitment. Then I will move to complementarity. Now, complementarity is synonymous to cooperation. It's about coaches and athletes working together. It's those actions and interactions that are perceived to be cooperative. And examples of cooperation includes being responsive to each other, being receptive, holding a friendly attitude or stance to one another, as opposed to being hostile, cold, or distant. Being at ease and comfortable in each other's presence is important. You can imagine how difficult it is if you are very uncomfortable in the presence of the coach or in the presence of the athlete. And I think these are so responsiveness, receptiveness, being comfortable and friendly. And these are the key characteristics of cooperation or complementarity. Another element that complementarity is trying to capture as well is the specific roles that the coach and the athlete play in the relationship, because that is also important to appreciate. And the coach is the one that directs, leads, supports, provides feedback, instructs. These are important qualities or behaviors that the athletes expect from the coach and form part of their behaviors. And then on the other hand, we've got the athlete who we expect to be able to execute instructions, to sieve information, to filter information that it comes from the coaches and other members. And these are important roles that the coaches and the athletes role, and they need to be complementary in many respects. Otherwise, conflict will erupt. And we know the devastating effects that conflict might have. And last but not least, co-orientation. Co-orientation is essentially capturing the degree to which the coach and the athlete are similar and they understand one another. I call it the common ground. Each coach and athlete in their dyadic relationship will have a certain common ground that no one else, no other relationship will have. And that common ground is very important. This is the shared knowledge and understanding that the coach and the athlete share, and it is very important to have. So it may be a coach and athletes knowing each other's likes, preferences, wants, needs, goals, and it is very important to have. And the bigger the common ground, the better the relationship. So this, Martin, these are the four dimensions that define the quality of the coach-athlete relationship. And it's important for coaches and athletes to use those terms to describe the relationship. Because without this definition, each one of us can have different descriptions, and it doesn't help when we talk about relationships.
There's some real big insights in there. Rebecca, do you see much of that within the practicalities of your experiences?
Yeah, I think when you say to a coach, effective coach-athlete relationships will help you succeed or reach performance outcomes, that's a no-brainer. I think everybody can get on board with that. But I think the level of detail there where we've got, you know, closeness and trust, respect, mutual liking, interpersonal commitment and what that represents, complementarity and co-orientation, it's so rich and multifaceted, and it's a lot to think of, you know, to help you guide each dyadic relationship. So in this context, we're talking about a team sport. So you've got to consider your managing up to the board. You've got your manager, you've got your head coaches, you've got your analyst, your psych, your nutritionist, your S&C, your physio, your therapist, and then a squad of 22 and 24 people. That's a lot of dyadic relationships. That's a lot of probably like small cluster groups. And then the coach has got to A, be aware of a really helpful guiding framework like this, which can help us check and challenge ourselves, help us make sense of where each dyad relationship is. So I, you know, just listening to you articulate it so clearly. So if I'm going, right, who have I got common ground with? Who do I know what their wants, needs, goals are? Do I know that information for each athlete? So I think it's really helpful, but it's also, you know, you've explained it so simply and easily. And what we're talking about, the reality of doing that well in practice consistently over a long period of time is hard, right?
Yeah, you're so right. And you're not the only one who will highlight to me that this is complex. This is really, really tough. You know, from a professional point of view, as a professional coach, as a coach who has a full-time occupation in this space, I will say there is no excuse. Relationships, if you accept that relationships are important, then you have to be systematic, you have to be deliberate in your approach, because we know, whether it is empirically or anecdotally, that the relationship matters. Each one relationship you develop with your athletes matter, not just with the good ones, the very good ones, the superstars that you have in the team, but each one relationship matters, particularly in a sport like you, Rebecca, where, you know, you've got a team of players. And like you indicated to me, there are a lot of players. In addition to that, you don't, you know, just, you know, work with a team of players. And let's make it absolutely clear, the way I see the coaches, I see them part of the team and not outside of the team. Often coaches perceive themselves or see themselves outside that group of athletes or the team of athletes. I see you as part of that. But also, like you said, you've got support staff around you, and you listed them, that you are aware, acutely aware, that you have to develop good professional relationships with them, and that is absolutely paramount. And also, you've got the people, you know, well above you, that again you need to know and understand, and relationships as important. And let's also put it, Martin, like this: relationships are not going to nurture themselves and maintained over time as good as they were in time one. They will need work throughout that time. You need to nurture them like a little flower. They will need watering. They will need the necessary nutrients so that they keep growing and developing. Otherwise, they will wither and die. So it is important to also mention that. The complexity is one, but we know, like you said, Rebecca, what that complexity involves. We know what relationships are, and you know what we need to do. They take time and a lot of nurturing.
I knew this would happen. I'm loving sitting, listening to you guys kind of put across these things, and the simplicity of the model, but the complexity of it. I think our listeners and myself have just kind of, you've nailed that, showing how simple and complex this is at the same time. I think to slightly add to what you're talking about as well, in that team environment, you've got to understand the relationship, the coach-athlete relationship of all those support staff, as well as the head coach, but also the inter-athlete relationships that they all hold as well. So the complexities there are so big in terms of the impact upon this on performance that you've already mentioned that there is evidence that these relationships do impact upon performance. We are starting to run out of time, and I know there's some bits, there's so many more things we can talk about. So I'm going to ask one question, and I know, Rebecca, you've got some questions that you wanted to add. So the one question, which is probably the most difficult question ever, is trying to give some advice to coaches out there. How would they use this model to implement this? We know it's good. We kind of got a model to do it. How would they try to do this in the field?
Yes, that is a super question. And of course, coaches will want to know, how do I do it? So I would probably say coaches first and foremost need to ask this very, very important question. What is my relationship like with athlete A, B, C, D? And they can profile it. They can ask questions, you know, how close? Do I trust that athlete? Does that athlete trust me? Am I committed to this athlete this season and next season and the season after that? And I also ask questions, why? You know, why do I feel the ways I do? And importantly, there will be coaches out there who operate in a team environment like Rebecca that may also want to ask, hang on a minute, there is that athlete that actually I have never talked to. Or if I talked to, it was a very superficial conversation that I don't really know him or her at all. So one of the, you know, things to support coaches at this point in time is to ask, you know, what are my relationship like with each one athlete in my team, and reflect why they are the way they are. And finally, how do I make them better? Or how do I maintain that good quality relationship that we have built together? So these are the three questions I will suggest coaches start asking themselves. What are my relationships like right this moment? Why are they the way they are, and how can I make them better? Does this help, Martin?
That is very helpful. And again, simplifying the complex is what an expert does. So well done. Thank you. Rebecca, I know you've got some burning questions that you want to jump in on. So do you want to jump in and ask anything you want to Sophia?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd just say thank you for that, because I made a little note of thinking about, you know, key question audit slash like a little checklist. So if you do have a group of athletes, how am I close with them? Boom. Am I committed to them? And I think that that's a really helpful, tangible tool for us to use. So I'm going to put that straight in my back pocket. Thank you very much. One of the kind of topical areas at the moment in coach education, when we're talking with practitioners, for me is this buzzword and space of psychological safety, and how we encourage athletes to, you know, be open in themselves without a fear or risk of being judged or released. And I just wondered if you could share your insights on what is psychological safety, and how it can be a really beneficial and helpful tool when we're thinking about coach-athlete relationships and these types of spaces.
That is a very good question. And you're so right. Psychological safety is also, almost a buzzword in sport at the moment. Everybody talks about psychological safety, it seems to me anyway. And in fact, we started in my world, in the research world, to investigate a little bit of what psychological safety is and means in sport. And there are scientists out there, colleagues of mine, who are very skeptical about the applicability of psychological safety in sport. My point of view, just so that you're clear, and based on the research we have done here, around psychological safety, is that psychological safety seems to point that there is value to examining and applying it in sport. So you asked me what is psychological safety. So psychological safety, according to the research that has been done outside sport in the business world, is about the belief that members of a team have about taking interpersonal risk without fear of intimidation or humiliation and so on. So it's the ability of members of a team freely expressing themselves, sharing difficult news or sharing new ideas or different ideas, raising concerns, simply being themselves. And how good environment that will be if one could be themselves, and if they have ideas, can share them freely and openly with the rest of the team. So this is what psychological safety is. And I think there is value to creating environments where people feel psychologically safe and they don't feel fearful to express themselves. It is as simple as that. And particularly in competitive sport, we reinforce a lot of competition with one another, a lot of rivalry, and psychological safety can be that element, that ingredient that pacifies this competitiveness that inevitably exists in sport, in competitive sport, in high performance sport. So I think coaches are the main protagonists in creating an environment where athletes and players can feel psychologically safe through their actions and behaviors. You need transformational leaders, leaders who can set the tone of that environment. They can explain what the expectation is. They can set the stage whereby they make clear to all of the athletes that here what we want to do is to operate as in a very cooperative environment as a true team, because simply as a coach, and here is one where vulnerability comes into place, as a coach you don't have a crystal ball, you don't have all the answers, you don't have all the questions either, and the athletes can help you in that way. So setting the scene and saying to your athletes that I want your contribution, I want your input, whether it is good or bad, I want to hear from you, and repeating that, making it a habit. And won't be easy. You may say it the first time and it will not land, but by creating that habit and reminding to the athletes that this is how you would like to operate as a coach, as a leader, then that would perhaps become part of the ways that the team and the players and you operate as a coach. And then, of course, you know, let's not forget that it may be that athletes understand the message you're trying to, or the environment you're trying to create, and they start opening up and they start being offering freely what you have asked from them, the reaction and the feedback they will get will be very instrumental whether that climate, that environment will continue to exist. So once athletes believe that, you know, you want their input and they come to you with their input, coaches need to be very careful how they will react. If they will react in a way that is receptive and they listen, then that is all good. But if they feel intimidated, if coaches feel intimidated by the input they receive, they feel uncomfortable and they show that, and this will be picked up. And I don't think they will see that athlete again knocking on their door with their input or feedback. And it's also role modeling, Rebecca, as well. You know, if you want certain behaviors from your athletes, the athletes need to see you role modeling. And I would say the other thing that is, I think, important and relative to what you said and important to you, particularly in the sport that you coach, I have heard it from coaches like yourself. I want coach athletes, players who can be innovative and creative. You know, I want them to go out and do something different and, you know, think a little bit outside from the box. But let's be honest, and Rebecca, I would like your input. How many athletes actually or players go out there and, you know, play outside of the box that they had been told, you know, from their coaches is the right sort of way of operation. I don't think many athletes have got that freedom, unfortunately. And when they do display that freedom of doing something that is creative or something a little bit different, or if it is a new skill, they try it in many different ways, but they don't quite do it correctly. And then they hear the coach, the feedback that often might be critical, you know, and negative. And unfortunately, they stop their athletes in their tracks. These are the things that one needs to think. So I'll hand back to Rebecca. So Rebecca, I know you want athletes who are innovative and creative, but tell me why the players cannot believe their coaches when they say, go out there and smash it?
I think it's a great question. And thank you very much for that detailed insight into that concept, because it gave me a lot to think about. And again, I was making a few notes here. I think, why can they not be creative? Let's pick that bit apart. I would say the coach designs the training program. You know, you'll go to the gym at this time, then you're on pitch, and then within the pitch sessions, it's warm up. I don't know, rondos, technical passing phase, 11v11, and then you're off. And the coach controls so many things. Do we create space, A, in schedules or sessions, for athletes or staff to be creative or innovative or think outside the box? So I guess that's my first call to action is, you know, coaches, try to create a bit of white space in your programs for people and see what happens. What if, for example, you weren't there? Then what happens? Like, that's the gold dust. Can the athletes run a session on them, you know, by themselves if you're not there? What happens? Who rallies around? Or the next one would just be, if we say we want these things, I think a good leader for me is do what you say. Like, if you're saying we want you to voice an opinion, good or bad, then create space to listen and then create space for a tangible action. And I think perhaps we could start working towards this. And maybe it just starts with that awareness piece. Are we aware of the perception? So role modeling is a great one. If there's a bit of a slip, because we're all human, right? Who checks and challenges you? Who feels psychologically safe to go, hey, Bex, by the way, you know, you're asking them to do this, but do you know you just did that? Because that's a tricky one, isn't it? To call out the people who are above you in a chain of command, right? So I think there's some great points in there for us to unpick a bit.
But also, Rebecca, it is interesting what you said there, because, you know, how many times did you or any coach who listens this interview here has actually asked their athletes for some feedback? You know, how did I do today? You know, how was it for you? You know, these are the things that they seem to be so common sense, but we don't do them enough, I don't think. And that is the role modeling, because once you ask, you know, your players, what do you think? How did I do today? You know, they may be more receptive to hear when you tell them how they did, or ask you, how did I do, coach, today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's gold dust for anyone who's listening today. Absolute gold dust there.
I think there's been a lot of absolute gold dust, as you put it there, Bex, that we've just had such a great listen to the conversation. I have anyway. I'm making notes as well for stealing things for me. So thank you to both of you. Sophia, you've given us a good insight into the background in coaching and that kind of coach-led approach, round to that athlete-led approach. And as you're now working on that coach and athlete-led approach, and I think the simplicity that you've talked about in the model, but along with the kind of complexities that we discussed as well, are clear for all to see. Hopefully some of our listeners will have some things to take away. As predicted at the start, we could sit here and I could listen to you guys forever. So normally I talk about what you're doing next, but I'd potentially like to kind of leave people on a cliffhanger, because we spoke about before you guys catching up and having a coffee and really getting to the nitty gritty and chatting. I would love to be part of any conversation where we might say, do you know what? we seem like we're midway through a conversation here. And, you know, without putting too much pressure on people here, I would love to further this conversation. I'm sure our listeners would love to have more of these podcasts in this space, which might talk about different angles of this part. But if it's all right with you guys, I would love to say, you know what? Let's leave this as a cliffhanger and let's say there's going to be more things coming out here because this conversation was awesome. I hope that's okay. We can have a coffee. We can see what more we can do. We can go from there. Putting you on the spot. Is that okay?
Absolutely fine with me. Yeah.
If the gaff is in, I'm in.
That's it. That's it. Right. So we're definitely going to sort. You guys can have a coffee. I will happily come and listen. And we can sort another podcast or two to move these conversations forward. So I do massively appreciate you coming on. I know we've ran over time, but I just couldn't kind of stop because it was great. So thank you very much. Sophia, I'm sure I will see you around the building. And Bex, we're recording again tomorrow. So I'll see you again soon.
See you guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Experts in Sport podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, then please contact me, Martin Foster, at m.foster@alborough.ac.uk. Thanks for listening. See you next time.